Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's move to our first story. I think I've given out all the info I need for contact. And as some of you may be aware, I am a happy and loving dog owner, and I have pretty much no intention of ever being without a dog. This only helps me feel this way even more. So two recent studies, and this came out of the American Heart Association's website, but these are research-based, published in Circulation, Cardiovascular Quality and Outcomes. So dog ownership was associated with a 33% lower risk of early death for heart attack survivors living alone and a 27% reduced risk of early death for stroke survivors living alone compared to people who didn't own a dog. It was also associated with a 24% reduced risk of all-cause mortality and a 31% lower risk of death by heart attack or stroke compared to non-owners. So let's just break that down. If I could give you a drug, believe me, if any of Big Pharma had a drug that was going to reduce your risk of mortality for your age by 25%, you cut your risk in death by 75%. Well, no, sorry. We would phrase it differently. We would say that we would find some way to state the statistics in a flamboyant way. But the odds of dying are lowered by having a dog. Now, these are not double-blind, placebo-controlled trials, and so there's a certain amount of leverage that happens when people become very sick. You know, they may give away their dog, so there's certainly a little bit of that going on. But this research comes out of Sweden, this study and these quotes, and they were people from 40 to 85 who'd had a heart attack or a stroke. So it was 33% for having a death from another heart attack, 15% lower for those living with a partner or a child. So even if you were living with somebody, you still got a 15% lower rate of heart attack of death with the dog. So partner plus dog, definitely your best move. Risk of death for stroke patients living alone after hospitalization was 12% if you had a partner, 27% if you were living alone. And the dog ownership piece is solid because in Sweden you have to register your dog. Let's go to this other data, and this was another study, a meta-analysis looking at 3.8 million people taken from 10 separate studies, composite, they added it all together. So compared to non-dog owners, and this is dog owners regardless of who they live with for this data, 24% reduced risk of all-cause mortality, 65% reduced risk of mortality after heart attack, 65%, and 31% reduced risk of mortality due to cardiovascular related issues. Dogs do more than warm our hearts. They exercise us and they make us feel less sad and less depressed. And depression, by the way, and loneliness, heart wounding in the spiritual sense, well, you know what? It turns out to wound the heart in the physical sense, you're more likely to have a heart attack if you're lonely or sad. And it's hard to be lonely or sad with those big brown eyes looking at you with just that expression. Sorry, I'm waxing a little maudlin here, but I can't help it. I love my dog. So maybe you should love yours too. We're going to go now to our first caller, and that is Roseanne in New Jersey. Okay. Hello, Roseanne.
Oh, hi, Dr. Dawn. Okay, I was excited when I got your email last week responding to me. That's why you're so cool. I love that about you.
Thank you.
And this was about, I'm having an MRA, and you said go ahead and have it on my carotid artery.
So and everybody's listening, so why don't you start from the very beginning and tell your story so that everybody can appreciate appreciate it.
Oh, I had an ultrasound of my carotid artery. It came back that they could not get a clear reading, so the doctor recommended that I have an MRA because supposedly you get a better picture of it. And That's what I've set up for. And my question to you was going to be, is there anything I should be taking before and after? Because I'm having it with contrast.
Mm-hmm.
So no way, you know, they put things in you. I already had my blood work done, and I'm okay for my kidney.
Good, good. Yeah, and the kidney is the main organ that's going to be getting rid of the contrast. And as long as, and we have been doing MRIs now for almost 30 years. And one of the things, this is a really interesting thing about the contrast, is if you measure it in the bloodstream, it evaporates very rapidly, leaves the bloodstream, and a lot of it shows up in the urine. And I was taught that, you know, it's gone from the body, it doesn't hang around. But there are people who have kidney problems who we have to be careful. Some of them will drop their kidney function radically. So we're really careful about even the MRI contrast in people with kidney trouble. But in other people, it hasn't been a problem. So you're in good shape.
Mm-hmm. And this is the MRA now. So
right.
It's the same type of test.
Right, and that stands for MR angiogram. And for the audience, basically, sound waves show a slowdown, an increase of the speed of blood through one of your carotid arteries. And usually the blood's moving faster if the carotid's gotten narrower. So the MRA is going to basically fill that artery with a chemical material that will show up on the magnetic resonance imaging. So we'll be able to see how thick the artery is. And if it's narrowed at a single spot, then you become a candidate for something called a stent or not. But we would certainly think about putting you on antiplatelet therapy. If it's a really tight block, they might push a stent on you. And I'm really glad you called because I want to talk about that. It really boils down not to how narrow you are. I mean, if it's like 99%, that's one thing. But if it's like 65% or 70%, then we're sort of in a quandary in medicine because we know that there's a possibility that person might have a stroke. But we also know that if we try to put a stent in there or do an endarterectomy, which is to remove the blockage surgically, that there is a really substantial risk that we will create a stroke, maybe as much as 7 to 10% or for a small mini stroke. But of course, this is an actual stroke that we're causing by doing the procedure. So you don't want to get the procedure if your actual risk of having a problem is lower than your risk of the procedure giving you the problem, right? That's our quandary. So we've been studying this for years, and we've kind of come up with some numbers. The 70% figure, if you're having TIAs, which is a transient ischemic attack, so that's where this area of the clot, this area of blockage is rough, and the platelets are jumping on it and forming little tiny clots. And then just like when you were a kid, did you ever go up to the mountains and there was a stream and you tried to build a dam and you built it with mud and the dam would break through and the little crumbly mm-hmm. bits of mud? So think of the clot as the little crumbly bits of mud, and the little pieces of it can get into your brain circulation and block something. So you don't want that happening. But since it's platelets, we have drugs for that. And there's this big fight between the surgeons and the internists, like there always is, because, I mean, this is like the cross-time rivalry of medicine, and the Trojans and the Bruins, because I'm from L.A. And what happens is that, you know, everybody argues about what's best, but ultimately there's this gray area, and that's at the 70%. So if you're having TIAs, yeah, time, you know, you fix the blockage. If you're not having TIAs, the debate is, well, how narrow do you let it get before you fix it? And I have not looked at the latest numbers, but it's going to be somewhere above 70% and somewhere below 90%. So what I'm hoping is that you are not in that gray area, that when they do this, it's like, oh, yeah, she's got a narrowing and it's a 45% narrowing. And everybody would say, okay, take an aspirin or take dipyridamol. But that's it. You know, you're just going to take a blood that makes your drug that makes your platelets a little less likely to clump. And then if you do have, and you should read up on the symptoms of a TIA. And basically what happens is it's like you get a blockage to something and the blockage melts. because it's not a very big blockage, and it melts just like that earthen dam that we started out talking about. So for a few minutes, you're not getting a good blood flow to the area, and maybe your side of your mouth droops, or your tongue gets a little fuzzy, or your hand feels clumsy. And you may not even notice it, but someone looking at you may say, hey, your mouth looks a little funny. And so when that happens, it goes away. Probably by the time you get to the ER, it's gone. That's a TIA. And so as long as the clot melts quickly, the brain recovers and you're good. But then you have to treat it more aggressively. And so depending on the narrowing, you might just double down on the antiplatelet drugs. If it's not a big narrowing, maybe put someone on a cholesterol-lowering agent. And this is one of the situations where I am down with the statins. I don't love the statins.
But yes, and he's pushing it, this guy, left and right.
Well, of course, because it's his rear end, honey, his rear end legally. You're from New Jersey, okay? You get lawyers, okay? Lawyers are sharks. Let's not put blood in the water, okay? And this is you in shark-infested waters with your period. And so this is how the doctor feels. He feels like the sharks are going to come and get me because this woman's going to have a stroke, and it's going to be my fault she wasn't on that I hadn't done everything I could possibly do, including twisting her arm to be on a statin, and her grieving family is going to be there, and the jury's going to, you know, and la, la, la. And that's the fantasy that plays in his head. And I share it too. I mean, I'm a victim of my own socialization, and that's our medical socialization. And the safe place to be as a doctor is in the middle of the school of fish, doing all of the things on the list of things you're supposed to be doing. And if you're doing standard of care medicine and something bad happens to the patient, you are safe. And if for whatever reason, because of lack of patient compliance or because you forgot, or maybe in fact because you are a negligent physician, you're not doing standard of care medicine, then you are, you know, you're on your period and there's in shark-infested waters and you get nervous. So that's where that vehemence is coming from. And, you know, we need to cop to it as physicians. That's part of our calculus. And I'm not saying that these guidelines don't have some legitimacy, but I am saying that if you go and look at who's on the boards of directors that make these guidelines, you'll find an awful lot of people in the pay of Big Pharma. And we're not talking change. You know, we're talking $50,000 to $100,000 a year in either grants or speakership fees or some combination of institutional support. I mean, look at that guy who just went down at MIT for accepting all that money from He Who Shall Not Be Named. I've heard that name enough. I don't need to hear it anymore.
Yes.
But but that kind of thing is going on all the time. And so when I look at the data, I'm like, okay, let's go to the basic science. Let me look at the study. Let me see who funded the study. Because you can always, if you're funding it, you can always not publish it if it doesn't go your way. And
Nice.
Yeah, and these guidelines, you know, they say, oh, they're research-based, and then you look at the bulk of the research, and it's funded by the company making the drug that it's recommending, and you have to kind of say, all right, well, where's some science that isn't potentially contaminated by conflict of interest? And there is, for this, decent science. But when you get into that gray area, that's market share, honey. And so that's when things get a little weird. So you can all, but where I'm going with you is if you want to get the MRA, that's not dangerous to you.
Yes.
I will tell you that some of that gadolinium stays in your body, but there is absolutely 30 years of evidence that it's inert and doesn't do anything to you. And so I don't care.
Okay.
I will be able, if I give you a drug and check your urine, I'd be able to tell if you'd ever had an MRI with contrast. But we've got no evidence at all that it causes problems. And we've had plenty of time for stuff to crop up. So I think we're cool. I really do.
Okay. Now, when I have argued with him with the statin, and I've been through this before with him, by not taking the statin, he's telling me that if the that because the plaque is there, that could break off and give me a stroke. So that's why I need to take a statin.
Well, let's figure out how big the plaque is, and then we'll talk. We don't know that yet.
Yeah.
And you know, in terms of things that you can do besides taking a statin, and this is absolutely evidence-based. You can go on an all vet, you can go on an all plant diet. You can exercise. You can meditate. You can take some supplemental fish oil. Go look up a guy named Dean Ornish, O-R-N-I-S-H.
Oh, yeah, I know him well.
And he did research in the early 80s, I think. I'm sure you can find it on the internet. And he basically compared taking a statin to doing a diet and exercise program. And when you look prospectively at who has the heart attack and who doesn't, it worked as well, or, and in some situations, better than a statin. You have to look at, does the person actually do the program? And certainly taking a pill is way easier than changing your lifestyle. But and that depends on your level of commitment to a healthy lifestyle. And also what your, and I would factor in your family history. If you've got a horrible family history and everybody has a stroke, you've probably got some genetic predispositions, and maybe it does make sense to take a statin. But the first thing I would, but the first thing I would do, if you have to take a statin, you got to take CoQ10, and you got to take a lot of it, and you got to monitor your blood level, because you got to have a normal blood level, and don't miss that piece, because statin alone is going to drop your CoQ10, that starves your mitochondria of one of their most important cofactors, and it's going to shorten the life of your brain cells. And it might lead to heart failure. There's good evidence that long-term statin use is associated with heart failure. And I think it's because the heart mitochondria run out are dying off. And I think we can prevent that with supplementation. And I have data to back that up. So that's always my advice to people.
Yeah, and I did take it with my last statin, but I got off the statin. So because I've said this before, my muscle cramps. I just read an article yesterday about statins being a problem for causing osteoporosis also, but I just bookmarked it, so I have to read it more thoroughly. You heard that?
I haven't, but send me a link. You've got my address.
Oh, okay.
Okay?
Okay, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And after I get the results, I'll call you back.
Well, thanks for listening all the way over there in New Jersey. Of course, it's only an electron sneeze away when you're on the internet. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Dawn. Bye-bye.
Bye. I want to talk about a potential breakthrough in nutrition science, and I don't use the word breakthrough that readily, but this is applying technology that I've been playing around in this particular garden for a while, and that's the gut garden, and looking at DNA probes that basically give me the pattern of bacteria that are actually in a person's poop. And we are looking at, you know, how much of each of the different families do they have, what sort of balance do they have. We have some normals, and we also can see outliers. And there's a lot of interesting correlations between things like low variability and a history of antibiotic use recently. We also see, as we start looking at over people's lifetimes and we start looking at kids, there's this kind of progression of how we develop our microbiome. It's pretty much stamped in stone by the age of 3, by the way. But human diet studies, you know, all these nutrition studies that you read, and they seem contradictory, and they are. And part of the reason is, how do you measure diet in wild-type humans? Okay, you can lock them in a motel for a couple of weeks and feed them. That gets expensive, not to mention the liability insurance. Or you can ask them to fill in a journal or a diary. But the problems are, you know, some people sit down at the end of the day and fill out the journal and they don't remember that donut. In fact, they've quite forgotten about it. Plus, they don't necessarily want to admit it because they know they're not supposed to be doing that because they're supposed to be following the diet and the science. And sometimes a person just forgets. So we got memory errors. We've got just the difficulty of identifying what they're eating. I mean, if you have ratatouille at a restaurant, what is that? It's got some eggplant, but what else is in there? And I mean, you don't know. And so it's really hard for the researcher. DNA metabarcoding is a new technique where they essentially do the chloroplast, which is kind of the analog to the mitochondria in a plant cell, and they do the DNA of the chloroplast. And this has been used and was developed to study what African savanna animals ate. So, you know, you can't necessarily track the animal, but you can collect their poop, and then you can figure out what they're eating and get a sense for how the ecosystem is operating. They sequenced the barcode region in stool samples from 11 individuals who were also on a doing journals, and they basically were able to amplify the plant DNA in the samples, and then they looked to see, does it match the diary, and can we tell what the people were eating? And it was pretty good. It was about 80% of the time, which is way better in terms of approximating reality than what we've got right now. And there's no reason they couldn't do it for meat DNA. So you could figure out, you know, what differentiates cow from sheep, from goat, from chicken. And then you could tell what, you know, what that you ate and roughly the proportions, but certainly the categories. It doesn't differentiate at this particular level that you can't tell the difference between cabbage, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and kohlrabi. They're all closely related, and the chloroplast DNA was identical. But interestingly enough, coffee is the only food in the diet that they could never detect. They could never find it. And maybe that's because we boil the heck out of the DNA. First we roast it, then we grind it, then we heat it up, and then we heat up some water and boil it some. So you got to admit you can imagine that DNA is pretty fried by the time it comes out in the other end. However, I see this as really allowing us to do nutritional research, and we won't be using diet diaries anymore, and maybe finally our nutritional research will actually show us what's going on. And believe me, I hate the credibility gap that this generates for us. I promised you some email. So this one from Sandra in Chapel Hill. Sandra writes, "Dry eyes. Thank you for your commitment to public service. I've been listening for 15 years. Go, Sandra. Thank you. Over the past 4 months, I've experienced 3 styes, 2 in 1 eye, 1 in the other, painful, uncomfortable, and ugly. I visited my ophthalmologist and was diagnosed with blepharitis, which is irritation of the eyelid glands. I was prescribed azacite, hot compresses, sterile wipes, and moisturizing eye drops. Could you please comment and advise any other supplements or treatments? I'd like to prevent future problems. I'm 75 and in good health. Thanks so much." Okay, so when I was in medical school, Sandra, I made a point, and we were doing our clinical rounds and later on in residency, same thing. I looked for the oldest doctor in the room because that was the one I figured had the most tricks that were probably not in the textbook. And it pretty much turned out to be true. So one of the tricks I picked up a long time ago was Johnson & Johnson's baby shampoo. You can use other baby shampoos, but this is the best one. And every night, and twice a day when you have a sty, you take a little wet washcloth. My favorite is the baby washcloths, the really thin ones. Cotton is better than microfiber. You want something that's a little rough, but not too rough. And you put a little baby shampoo on that washcloth, warm water, and you just scrub along the base of the eyelid margins. Above and below, you do this with your eyes opened or closed because it's baby shampoo. Fill up the sink with water and rinse. And this does a couple of things. It mechanically opens up the pores of the meibomian glands, which are the glands that are basically the oil glands for your eyelashes. And they produce also a lubricant that keeps the tears from melting, from evaporating. So they're important for keeping your eyes from being dry eyes. And the baby shampoo trick, often I will use this when people come to me with just a dry eye problem, along with my second suggestion, which is a compound called sea buckthorn oil. So S-E-A, then new word, B-U-C-K, thorn, like a tree thorn or a rose thorn oil. This is an omega-7. Now, we all know omega-6 and omega-3, and maybe we know omega-9, which is your olive oil, but omega-7, I don't know from anywhere, omega-7, this stuff is very good for tears, and it's very moisturizing for the eyeball, and my people with dry eye have found this very helpful. I have a touch of dry eye on one side, and it really does make a difference. So dosing, maybe 500 to 1,000 milligrams a day, not that expensive. So that plus the baby shampoo. I don't have any problem with the hot compresses and the sterile wipes and the moisturizing eye drops. I don't like to use an antiseptic on a tissue anymore unless I've got a really good reason. And that has to do with the fact that I want there to be a healthy microbiome. I understand now that when I sterilize a surface on my body, that surface has to regenerate its protective microbiome. So I need a good reason, like I'm about to poke a needle into it or I've just gotten cut and I know it's contaminated. That's a different story. It's all risk-benefit. But in terms of just throwing antibiotics at something that's not infected so it won't get infected, I don't know that that's going to help, and I think it might do more harm than good. So I'm pretty conservative there. I hope that helps. Long-distance email, this from Richard in Metro Detroit. Interesting that you specify the metro there. Anyway, hyperemesis gravidarum. My daughter has been diagnosed with hyperemesis gravidarum. This is a Latin term which translates to pregnant and throwing up a lot. I'm not kidding. That's what it means. It sounds so much better in Latin. It seems to me that this is really just a collection of symptoms rather than a definitive diagnosis. When I Google it, they say generally no one really knows the cause. Of course, your usual gut gardening seems like a good and safe action. I thought I read some comment about B6, and I vaguely remember you talking about genetics possibly causing a decreased ability to process some vitamins. My daughter has been sequenced, Mayo Clinic's GeneGuide Helix affiliate, and I think we could now ask for specific tests if you think something is warranted. If you need an additional topic to talk about, this might be the one. Also, the difference between hyperemesis gravidarum and just morning sickness, as a male, I would never actually say just morning sickness to a woman, but I added it for contrast. Yes, I understand you are a new age sensitive guy, Richard, and I applaud that. That's a hilarious song, by the way, guys, if you've never heard it. Getting back to your question, hyperemesis gravidarum is where you're so sick, you really can't stop throwing up, you're losing weight, and you're getting dehydrated. And it is a serious medical condition. And the very first thing that you need to do in this situation is you need to start monitoring quantitative beta HCG levels, because the beta HCG is the pregnancy hormone. It's the one that the urine test for pregnancy checks for. And the range that the placenta puts out is very broad in humans. And in people whose placenta is putting out a lot of it, they will tend to vomit more readily. It seems to, the second and third pregnancies seem to go easier. But, you know, functionally what's happening is these high levels of a hormone in the bloodstream are confusing the hypothalamus, and it sends a signal to the medullary vomiting center saying, you know, I think this person just ate something that's bad for them, like Datura or Jimson weed, so let's throw that up. But of course the levels in the blood don't drop, so the vomiting continues. But if the beta HCG levels are going up more rapidly than to be expected in a normal pregnancy, she needs an ultrasound, and pronto. Maybe she's already had that, and that's good. But the thing that you have to watch for is something called a molar pregnancy. And the molar pregnancy is basically a placenta tumor. So you don't have a baby in there. What you have is a placenta all by itself, which is just growing and growing and growing. And you will test positive for pregnancy. This can even be a cancer. And this, if it is a cancerous placenta, this is a very aggressive thing, and it needs to be found promptly. So I hope she's had an ultrasound. If she hasn't, she should. And she should be getting cereal. That I would say every couple of days, every 3 or 4 days for a week or two, just to get enough data points so that you can plot the curve and see how fast that's going up. Because if it's continuing to go up, you can look at the norms for the stage of pregnancy. First it goes up, then it drops a little bit, then it stabilizes. That has to be investigated. With respect to your sequencing, I'm not particularly familiar with the Mayo Clinic's products, but I am assuming that this is probably similar to the similar to, say, 23andMe or the Ancestry.com products, which are exon sequencing. So they're just looking at the DNA that codes for proteins, and that's very useful. When you're talking about the B vitamin issue, sometimes people use high doses of B6 for to help with vomiting. It's particularly used in migraine. I'd be a little nervous using it about someone who's gestating, particularly in the first trimester. I think it would be classified as generally recognized as safe. The thing I was talking about on the show, which is very worthwhile for her to do, is the MTHFR. So this is not a dirty word. This is methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. And this mutation, if she has it, means that her body can't process folic acid, and this is associated with all kinds of birth defects. And if you take a pre-processed form of folic acid called 5-methylfolate, you reduce the risk of these birth defects. And some of the worst of them are cleft palate, cleft lip, and cleft spinal column, which can, you'll remember the Zika virus babies being born with the tiny brains. That's on the table for people who don't get enough folic acid during pregnancy, and that is a horrible thing to have to deal with, something that I would not wish on my worst enemy. And so getting any pregnant woman checked for MTHFR, in my opinion, should be the standard of care in medicine. Unfortunately, it's not. But since you have this sequence, I'm pretty sure that they can probe for MTHFR, and presumably, because that is a well-known mutation with high prevalence in the population, up to 3% of people have at least one mutation, so the odds of getting two bad copies are not remote. That's something to think about doing. I hope that helps. And ginger, okay, in terms of treatment things that really work, ginger does wonders, and ginger's a food. People eat large quantities of ginger. It's never been linked with any adverse side effects. So lots and lots of ginger will help with the vomiting. Plus, since you can put it into a tea, it's easy to deal with and very safe for babies. This is kind of clanging on the earlier story I did before the emails. Who's telling the truth about their health? This was a study. You know, sometimes you look at these studies and you go, oh my God, why are we doing this? Why did they spend the money to do this? But okay, it's kind of funny in that respect. But researchers looked into how reliable self-reported data is rather than tested data. Because obviously, if you're going to have a nurse test something, that's way more expensive than if you just have people check a box. And so they're looking at self-reported data versus tested data. They looked at microdata for 100,000 individuals over the age of 50 in 19 European countries, because, hey, it's the EU. And they decided, they wanted to see how old were you, how reliable were you by age? And was reliability different between different countries? And because, you know, there's different cultures. Turns out that it's really funny. If you are a Northern European compared to a Southern European or an Eastern European, so the South, Central, and Eastern Europeans misrepresent their physical and cognitive abilities. They give themselves better grades than they've got. The Northern and Western Europeans, so I'm thinking, you know, the sort of dour, critical people in the Nordic countries, kind of strict with themselves, they tell the truth about their physical and cognitive abilities. And the other thing is that the older you get, the worse you do on telling the truth. If you're between 50 and 54, your self-reported ability and your observed ability are right about 85% of the time. But if you are in the group of 90 to 94, only 65% of people actually, and maybe it's just that they don't remember that they can't get out of a chair without using their arms, but it definitely is a variation. And, you know, you got to find that a little bit funny. My next story is about prenatal stress and recent research. There's been, this is coming after a lot of work in animals and in particularly kind of torturing mice while they're pregnant and then seeing how anxious the baby mice are. The answer is very. This study was looking at maternal stress and brain development. So getting back to the self-reporting piece that we just covered, there were the women who were pregnant were specifically asked about how much stress they had during pregnancy. So when they did that, and the types of stresses we're talking about are losing your job, having to move, death of a friend or a family member, separation, divorce, spousal infidelity. There's a lot that can happen during pregnancy, just like there's a lot that can happen during life. When you looked at the brains of these babies, and I think they used this because they were going to be looking at the brains of these premature babies anyway, so they could bootstrap off of it, they had a medical imaging technique I've not heard of before called diffusion tensor imaging. So this is coming off of MRIs, of course, and it was developed to look at the structure of the white matter. And for those of you who don't know, the gray matter is the processor and the white matter is the cabling. So obviously the processor can be doing well, but if the cabling isn't working or the cabling is miswired, the machine is not necessarily going to do what it's intended to do. These sorts of changes in white matter have been implicated in adults with anxiety disorders. In other words, when you use this technique on a scan in someone who's got chronic anxiety, you can see differences in the structure of their brain, and those differences occur primarily in the white matter. What they found was the higher the mother's stress during pregnancy, the more white matter alteration they saw in the babies. And over years and years, we've really gotten the message out to screen for depression, because postpartum depression is a serious illness. It can lead to suicide, infanticide, and so we've done a good job of getting doctors and midwives and nurse practitioners who are working with pregnant women to screen them for depression. But very few ask about general stress and anxiety. For one thing, it prolongs the visit. And for another, you don't feel like you can do much about it. And maybe you're actually adding to the stress by bringing it up. But now we know that maybe what we need to do is flag those cases where there is high stress and get those women some therapy or some help. A friend of mine was just telling me about the experience of her friend who is currently pregnant in France. And the European Union nations, particularly those with comprehensive health care, have figured out that the money you spend early, you make back tenfold later in absence of sick people. So they are into prevention, and they may be overdoing it, or they may have it just right. I can't say, but people get to stop working the last month of their pregnancy, and as soon as they're home, someone is coming out from the French social services and helping with the groceries, helping make sure that the house is baby-proofed, that they've got what they need in terms of resources and furniture and baby materials. And then for a month after, they're coming in and they're checking on the breastfeeding and they're troubleshooting. And so there's an enormous amount of support, which 100 years ago, if you were lucky, was provided by your sisters and your grandmother and everybody else. And now it's institutionalized. And I think that's a very good thing. I also think that since we have a whole lot of people who could do this, because this is lore, this is women's, I'm sorry, this is a kind of thing that we know how to do, women that is, and so I think that it could lead to jobs, it could lead to employment, it could be a way of getting people a job that they would actually enjoy and creating community engagement and all sorts of good things. So I know I'm being all Pollyanna-ish, but we know that we get obstetrical complications, lower birth weight, premature birth, and now when the mother is stressed and we now know that we set the baby up for chronic anxiety for the rest of their life if we don't take steps to alleviate that stress. So this is a real thing, and I hope that as we move forward as a society, we will seek ways to try and address it. This article caught my eye. This is from the August issue of New Scientist, which is a sort of a British popular science publication that I somehow managed to have gotten a subscription to. It's not bad, actually. Ketogenic diet for migraine. This is discussing a study. This was done in Italy. And ketogenic diet, of course, it's very popular on the internet right now. And you've heard here, if you eat a diet that is very low in sugar and rapidly available starch, it can have vegetables in it, but it can't have sweets, and you have to keep the fruit down. But a true ketogenic diet changes what the brain is eating. And that's really key. So you're breaking down fat instead of breaking down sugar. The brain loves its sugar, but it can run on ketone bodies. And when you start running, it's kind of like when you change the gasoline in your engine. It can change the way that the engine performs. So in the case of the brain, people with epilepsy and people with schizophrenia do better. When you're talking about Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease, if you can really keep the person on a ketogenic diet, they do better. And there's research out there that establishes it. But these researchers were interested in migraines. Some of the previous studies with epilepsy and people who also had migraines had looked like, maybe that helps. But no one had really done the definitive study. So they took 35 overweight or obese men and women who were migrainers. And they were randomly assigned to a diet. That's important to talk about the technique here. These were prepared meals diets. So we have to assume that maybe some of the people cheated and lied about it, but they didn't have to shop. And the food was right there. It was smoothies and soups. They looked identical, tasted pretty much identically. And so people didn't know what they were getting. They had the same amount of calories and fat, but very different ratios of carbohydrates and protein, designed to create ketone bodies in the people who were eating the low-carb ketogenic diet. So about 74% of people while they were on the ketogenic diet had less than half the number of migraine effective days as normal. And the control group was 9%. Now, the very best drug we have for migraine prevention cuts the migraine affected days by half for about 30% to 40% of users. So we're talking almost double what our best drug can do in terms of prevention of migraine. So that's pretty impressive. Now, ketogenic diet is not easy. It also does help with weight loss. So I'm sure that's why people on this were motivated. If you were having lots of migraines, you could do way worse than going on a multivitamin and doing a real ketogenic diet. But let me tell you about ketogenic diets, folks. You really have to do it. You can't cheat. You can't just have the donut and then drink your coconut oil. That is like the worst possible thing you can do for your vascular system. If you're going to do it, you have to do it. And if you can get through the first 3 days, it's actually pretty easy. The trick is not to cheat. You won't be hungry. It'll be habit eating. It'll be habit cravings. And the first 3 days are the worst. So, go to a keto camp or something. But once you are through the hump and the microbiome has shifted, which we know happens at about 36 hours, and by your time you're 3 days out, your bacteria has shifted. The ones that were making you crave sweets have died back. And if you keep feeding the ones that like fat, then you will start having very few food cravings. And it's a good way to lose weight. But if you've got migraines all the time and you're missing work and you're missing school and you're miserable, you're motivated. So I think that we can leverage this new data, and I think it would be super interesting for migrainers out there to give it a shot. And if it works for you, please give me a call and let me know that, or send me an email from the AskDrDawn.com site. So a little history lesson. Back in the 60s, in the early 60s, there was a... This is about morning sickness, so it associates beautifully with our earlier email. There was a new drug. It was a miracle drug. It was used to help with sleep, and it was used to help with morning sickness. It was called thalidomide. It was a fabulous drug, and it was used quite widely in Europe, and a number of people who traveled got some while they were in Europe and gave it to their wives because it really worked. Then the baby started being born. And suddenly there were more babies being born without arms and legs. And some of them had weirdness in their ears. Some of them had defective organs. And I remember it would have been maybe 1966, the Life magazine with this cute little girl, looked like Carolyn Kennedy, as I remember it anyway, with no arms. And, you know, in a frilly dress. And I'm not sure if it was on the front page or in the interior. But that image is still in my head. Because as a child, of course, you're like, oh my God, that poor kid. Well, this was an epidemic in Europe. In the United States, the drug didn't get through the FDA, thanks to one recalcitrant bureaucrat whose name I unfortunately have forgotten. And that was it. We pulled thalidomide, it went away, no more bad babies. But thalidomide's actually a really interesting drug. It's anti-inflammatory, and it turned out to be really great for treating a type of blood cancer called multiple myeloma. In fact, it was super curative therapy. It also works like gangbusters for leprosy. So in the year 2000, it got reapproved for specific uses, and with all kinds of pregnancy, fertility, you know, double, triple birth control, people screwed up. We've had a few more thalidomide babies, but nobody really wants to give up this really excellent cancer drug. A group of researchers, these are at Tokyo Medical University, have been looking at zebrafish, which are zebrafish are a great model. They grow fins, and thalidomide stops them from growing fins, and they reproduce quickly, so you can study thalidomide. The researchers in 2010 were actually able to figure out what was going on with the thalidomide. It's a compound called cereblon, and that thalidomide binds to this stuff, and it causes the new blood vessels to die back. So if you're a limb bud, which is just a lump of cells on the surface of this salamander that is destined, in the case of a mammal, to become an arm or a leg, or a front leg or a back leg, the blood flow gets interrupted, it never grows, and you end up with a stump. The ears are the same thing. They were even able to find out which proteins, a category of protein called P63, was at work. So now that the mechanism for the teratogenicity, which teratogenesis is the making of monsters, or as to say, a birth defect-causing drug. So now that they've figured out the mechanism, they can now try to design a molecule that doesn't do this, and the loyal little rapidly breeding zebrafish will tell them when they've gotten it done, and maybe we will have a kinder, gentler, and, of course, patentable thalidomide coming down the path. That did sound cynical, I'm sorry. Coming down the path in the near future. Got time for a science lesson, just... We're going to talk about neutrophils. This story, also from The New Scientist, got me started on this concept. We know that gallstones grow from crystals in the gallbladder, but it's never been clear what causes them to accrete. It seems now that immune cells are to blame, that is to say, inflammation, the root of all evil. While studying bile, Martin Herman at, this is a great school, the Friedrich Alexander University Erlangen-Nuremberg in Germany, and his colleagues made this discovery. They were looking at small gallstones after people had their gallbladders removed, and they found something we call neutrophil extracellular traps. And this is something that the neutrophils, which are one of the big, this is the polymorphonuclear lymphocytes. If you have a CBC, you'll see that there is the PMNs, And there are the lymphocytes, and those are the two main types of white blood cells. And without going into too much detail, the PMNs go after bacteria. They are part of the innate immune system. They recognize bacteria immediately. And when they see a bacteria, they spit out this kind of spider web of protein and DNA that's called a neutrophil extracellular trap. These sticky webs of DNA trap the microbes, keep them from migrating, getting into the bloodstream. And if these happen in the gallbladder, they will trigger the formation of a gallstone. So just like in a supersaturated or a supercooled liquid, if you just drop a tiny grain of sand into a supercooled liquid, the whole thing will freeze up immediately. This is a phenomenon called crystal seeding. And what we can see is that even though gallstones are made of bile, these sticky webs pulled cholesterol and calcium crystals together to create a stone, and the whole thing just basically reeled out. It's like, imagine someone throwing out one of those fishing nets that you see in Vietnam, and it has rocks on the ends of a round net, so it spreads out beautifully. I have some great pictures from my Vietnam trip. But anyway, so it lands in the water, and you gather it up, and there's a whole bunch of fish trapped in it. Well, now imagine that net is being thrown out by the neutrophils, and it's pulling in bile and pulling the bile together in a drawstring and creating the gallstones. Pretty cool, huh? These particular neutrophil extracellular traps also turn out to be key in asthma. We've got just a minute, so I'm going to try to do this quickly. Researchers were using mice, and they created asthma in the mice by exposing them to, get this, excessive hygiene. They could also poison them with ozone. But excessive hygiene actually is a risk factor in mice for asthma. Those mice, their microbiomes, they need those bugs. So same thing with humans that are raised in super hygienic environments. That's why the whole barnyard thing as a protective for allergies comes in. Anyway, what's going on in here is that in a super hygienic environment, the neutrophils are going hunting for something to kill. And they go into the lungs. And they start throwing out these lassos. So the minute that you give them something to kill, they're like, great. And all of these neutrophil extracellular traps get thrown out into the lungs, and it creates the chemical phenomenon that creates the asthma. I'll have more about this later on because it's really cool, and I'm going to read up on it. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.